Today's program has been brought to you by TechServe, New York's original and still the best Apple computer, iPod, and iPhone store and repair shop. For more information, visit TechServe.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Helen Holliman, and I'm back for another week of radio at Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And before we get started today, I just want to give a happy birthday shout out to our favorite president slash executive producer, Jack Inslee. Happy birthday, Jack. And on today's show, I'm joined by Ryan Sutton, the food critic at Bloomberg. Ryan, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Helen.
So for, you know, all of our listeners out there, I want to rewind the tape and ask how you got your start as a food critic and what sort of led you to that.
Well, it's glad you asked me, Helen. How kind. Thanks for having me on the show. It's sort of a long story about how I became a food writer and a food critic. You know, no one really has their lifelong goal of being a food critic. A lot of us, you know, want to be a journalist, which is, you know, what I wanted to do when I was a young 22-year-old and 21-year-old living in Washington, D.C., having just graduated from college. Like many other young people, I had journalism internships, but unfortunately, those journalism internships didn't exactly pay the bills. So like everyone else, I took jobs waiting tables, first in Clyde's of Georgetown, a fine place in Georgetown, Washington, D.C., and then later at Zola Restaurant. And it's through working at these restaurants that it, you know, really reintroduced me to the culinary world. I grew up in a restaurant family of sorts. My father, before I was born, worked in lots of, you know, catering halls. My mother, while I was growing up, worked in a bakery outlet called L'Italie's Guy Pascal. Guy Pascal was a prominent New York City pastry chef. And so, you know, as I told many people, when I grew up, you know, some kids got to play the, I don't know, the French horn or learn how to play the piano, and I didn't have to order off the kids' menu. That was sort of the luxury that my blue-collar family afforded to me. But in any case, rewinding back to Washington, D.C., I was pursuing a journalism career and a human rights career. I was working for the International Campaign to Ban Landmines. It was a Human Rights Watch-funded group. And in any case, after about a year, I was really happy with my career. I thought things were skyrocketing. And then all of a sudden, they bring me in. You know, my one-year contract is up. And they said, you know, listen, you did a great job, but we're not renewing your contract. And I was professionally, it's counted as one of the worst days of my life. I was professionally devastated. I didn't know what to do. My friends came and consoled me because I thought I was going to be this big, you know, journalist, human rights researcher, Russian speaker. And instead, I walked into a restaurant 2 weeks later and I applied for a job. And that's what kind of kicked off my modern food and wine career.
I think it's pretty interesting that you actually have worked in restaurants because, you know, there are a lot of food critics out there who haven't, you know, actually waited tables or cooked in a kitchen at times. And I think that that's something really key. So very interesting fact about you. So tell me, you know, you recently had an interesting perspective on Arlington Club. Tell me about that review and tell me about the experience that you had there.
Well, I had a pretty negative experience there, and I've generally had pretty negative things to say about steakhouses. I think Josh Ozersky wrote a really lovely piece for Time magazine called The Problem with American Steakhouses, and it reflects a series of beliefs that a lot of us, including myself, have had, that American steakhouses no longer serve the best steaks. And I think that's, you know, due to a lot of different reasons. You know, the American palate and the American stomach and American gastronomy has changed a lot since the days where we wanted, you know, 22-ounce ribeyes. That's not to say it's, you know, not lovely to indulge in something like that once in a while. And when I do, I go to a place like Keen's or the Dutch, perhaps Minetta Tavern. You know, I have a nice dry-aged steak, a steak with character, a steak with a mineral tang, with a little bit of musk, maybe even a little bit of liveriness. to it. And that's why I like those restaurants. Restaurants like Wolfgang's, Arlington Club, Bill's, a few other restaurants I don't want to name because I'm still in the process of reviewing them, serve pretty mediocre steaks. Steaks that, you know, corn-fed, you know, leave a little bit of oily taste on the mouth. Of course, the steaks, I think, are corn-fed at Mineta Tavern as well, and they're finished on grass. The steaks, I just didn't find that they have a whole lot of character. But I guess, you know, if we're trying to think of a larger perspective on, you know, why Arlington Club is relevant and why criticism is relevant, it's funny because a lot of my peers had very positive things to say about the restaurant, and I respect their reviews as well. And, you know, the thing is that every single review cycle, I guess you usually have one critic in the minority, so usually have one outlier critic. I remember Adam Platt, you know, he wasn't in, you know, the majority when he reviewed Elena Allegretti's restaurant. You've had other critics who have been outside the majority in, you know, other restaurants. And, you know, I just happened to be in the minority on this one. I experienced bad service, some of the worst service I've experienced in my life. I think it's been indicative of the experiences I've had at other Tao Group restaurants, such as Lavo and Tao, and now Arlington Club. And so while I was hoping, like everyone else, that would have been the fantastic reboot of Chef Laurent Tarandel, one of the city's great fish chefs, we all lament the demise of Cello, of course, that, you know, that ended a while ago, that fine restaurant. But that said, I'm in the minority on this one, and so be it. I think it's, you know, it's good for democracy and good for... it's good for food criticism and good for the consumers. You know, someone once asked me when Sam Sifton, you know, filed his 4-star review of Del Posto, and I was actually in the process of reviewing that restaurant myself, and I filed my review about a month later. I ended up giving it 2 stars, and Sky was asking me, like, listen, you know, who is the consumer going to believe, you know, Sam Sifton or Ryan Sutton? And I said, listen, first of all, I'm not in the business of criticizing other critics, and second of all, you know, it's a good thing because some people are going to read Sam Sifton reviews at 4-star Del Posto, and they're going to say, hey, this is great, this is exactly what we want, and some people are going to read Ryan Sutton's review and find out how I was treated, and they're going to say, hey, you know, I'm with Ryan Sutton on this one. And that's, you know, it's good for food criticism, it's good for the diner, it's good for the restaurant to, you know, for not to be one point, you know, it's not a unipolar world of food criticism. It's not, you know, the United States and Russia. It's the United States and Russia and China and Brazil and India, you know, and all the countries of the world. And that we live in a multipolar food criticism world, and I think that's a very good thing.
Food critics have been around for a very long time. And, you know, your purpose has always been, I mean, stating the obvious, is giving the reader sort of their first glance or an accurate sort of overall view of a restaurant. But beyond that, what do you think is the importance of a food critic? And what do you think is your job beyond just telling, you know, the reader about the service and the actual quality of the food?
Oh, gosh, great question. I could go about that in a different ways. I often tell people, and perhaps this is because I like to say I write for everyone, but of course I work for Bloomberg, and so to a large extent, I try to do a good job of representing the voice of the hardworking men and women of our great financial community, who provides our city with so much good tax revenue. But that said, I like to think the job of a food critic is catching up. And I think that's very important because a lot of people have a perception of a food critic as someone who goes out and wines and dines and overindulges and eat things that normal people don't eat. And that's completely untrue. And it's especially untrue with the case of, you know, the New York's great financial community and our community of lawyers. And I mean, listen, a lot of these people, these hedge funders, these bankers, these hedge fund analysts and these lawyers, they're eating out every single night of the week. They may not be going to Per Se every night, but they may be going to the new Beatrice Inn or to Monkey Bar. A lot of them are eating out in Brooklyn right now in places like Roberta's and Blanca and, you know, the Chef's Table at Brooklyn Fair. And they're eating out every single night of the week. And, you know, it's funny, this restaurant I'm reviewing right now, whose name I'll keep to myself, it's in the West Village, and I've been there a few times, and I talked to one of my interdealer broker friends, and I'm like, how many times have you been there? He goes, 10 times. And, I mean, listen, obviously, not everyone gets a chance to eat at a restaurant 10 times, and I certainly don't before I review. I usually visit a restaurant 3 to 4 times before reviewing it. But listen, I'm just catching up to these guys, you know, to have the same level of, if I want to have that discussion with them, I need to go as much as I can, and I need to eat out as much as I can. So when people ask me, what's the point of food criticism? It's to catch up to the people who are already eating at these restaurants multiple times right after they open, and then in the long term as well. So that's perhaps one way of answering the question. And the second part of answering the question is, you know, I guess what you'd expect from a food review. I often talk about four different parts of a food review. There's the, of course, the most basic aspect, which is the civic journalism aspect. You know, I like this and I don't like that. And that's, you can pretty much get that from a Yelp review. So we're trying to go for something a little bit more. So that's part one. Part two is the context and, you know, why this restaurant is important, where it stands in the place of society. You think of Roberta's, and I often, you know, classified in the what I call the budget gourmet movement. You know, the stripped down setting, slightly noisy. You know, benches, you know, for seats. Not all the seats have lumbar support, but you have this excellent, ambitious food. It's part of the budget gourmet movement. So that's why the restaurant's important. So that's part two. Part three is the vicarious experience. You know, 90% of the people who read your restaurant review aren't actually going to go to the restaurant. They just want something nice and peaceful to read on their lunch break. And so you want to try to transport them to somewhere else and, you know, tell a funny story or, tell them a funny story and try to explain what the restaurant's about and what it's like to eat, you know, foie gras with a Chateau de Chem Sauternes, which is something I more or less had at Adore Len Ducasse before it closed. And then the fourth part, which is kind of, you know, the Sutton spin of sorts, is I like to talk about value and I like to talk about prices. It's part of what I do in the Price Hike and the Bad Deal, my two blogs, but it's also something I like to bring to my restaurant reviews, and that's also, it's reflective of the fact that I work for Bloomberg, and we're a very, you know, data-heavy company, and so I try to bring an intelligent discussion about prices into many reviews I can. If you often look at any of my headlines en masse, I try to have a price in most of my headlines. Sometimes my editors take them out, but in almost any single headline I submit to my editor, there's probably going to be a price in that, and that's because, listen, if you can't afford the meal, you know, what... I mean, of course, you want that vicarious experience, but if there's not if you don't have enough prices in the article, you're doing the reader a disservice because they're not going to know whether they can afford this or not, and you end up selling an experience instead of accurately reporting about the experience.
So I've got a twofold question. First part is, what is the hardest part of being a food critic? And the second part is, has anyone that you've reviewed ever sort of come to your home, so to speak, with a baseball bat, metaphorically speaking? You know, have they sort of come up to you and just been like, hey, man, what was that about? Or, you know.
Pardon me. Let me answer the second part of your question first. No one has ever come to my home with a baseball bat. As I tell many people, I split my time between Manhattan and Long Beach. My heart is in Long Beach, and I just found out that my neighbor is a manager at a steakhouse that I gave a very bad review to. My father's chatting me recently. It's like, hey, how you doing? You know, where you from? And the guy's like, oh, you know, I'm this manager at the steakhouse in Midtown. And you're like, which steakhouse? And he goes, rah, rah, rah. I'll keep the steakhouse to myself, the name of the steakhouse to myself. And, you know, my father politely declined to name the profession of his son. I live with my father in Long Beach, and then I, of course, live alone in Manhattan, as a single guy does. But that said, so no one has ever come to my house with a baseball bat, but we're trying to protect my identity from this neighbor. It was a pretty torturous review. Second part of the question, what's the hardest part of my job? I mean, listen, you know, shed a tear for a food critic. I live a pretty good life. You know, I'm eating out in someone else's dime. But that said, like any job, you know, or like any long-term relationship, you have your ups and you have your downs. You know, I often joke with people that I'll be walking to some long tasting menu, you know, one of those 20, 30 course jobs. And 9 times out of 10, when I'm walking to a tasting menu, I'm going to pass a street stand, you know, lamb, beef, halal, you know, whatever, you know, all sorts of good flavors, you know, wafting out of there. And I think to myself, man, I could kill my hunger in like 4 minutes with $5, my own money. And I could do that right now. But instead, I have to walk into a tasting menu. And I know I'm not going to get, like, bread for the first 2 hours of the tasting menu. It's going to be, like, a separate course. And it's going to be a long time. But that's, you know, that's part of the job. It's not the worst problem to have. And, of course, I'm poking fun at tasting menus, and we can talk about this later. I really do love tasting menus. But, man, sometimes you just want to kill that hunger right away. You know, you want the white sauce, red sauce, and chicken and beef combo.
How many times a week are you cooking at home and not eating out?
Yeah, I often joke that I want to have my, you know, kitchen taken out of my apartment so I can have like a larger entertainment center, because I really don't cook at home at all. I do cook in Long Beach at home. On Sundays, me and Dad and Mom, you know, we do a little bit of cooking, you know, roast beef and, you know, stuff like that, pretty basic stuff. Sometimes I'll grill up a few ramps when they're in season, and, you know, I don't cook a whole lot, and I probably should, because just as a good writer reads a lot, a good food critic should cook a little bit more. So if there's a flaw in the certain There's a flaw in the Sutton personality. I should do a spot more of cooking. And there's nothing better than, you know, a nice, heavy, rich braise in the winter and a Le Creuset. I'm pretty good at making beef neck. So, you know, it's just, you know, it's like any braise, you know, dry heat, you know, wet heat for a while and, you know, let it sit overnight and then boom, there's a party.
That sounds pretty awesome. Do you put any booze in there? Or?
I put a little bit of wine.
Oh, okay.
Definitely put a little bit of red wine. I burn off the alcohol first, you know. You know, the whole process, you know, your aromatics, let it, you know, sit in the wine, and you dry heat in the beef, throw it in the aromatics, you know, with the tomatoes, and then I just let it cook down for about 8 hours. Let it sit overnight to let the, because what happens when you braise is all the collagens come out of the meat, and so if you serve it that same night, it's going to be all dry, and so you have to let it sit overnight to let the collagens that have turned from solid into liquid infuse back into the meat, and then after you're done with that, you strain it all out, you strain the sauce, you take your meat, and you sear it on pickup, and so you can get a little bit of sear because, you know, you want some texture, and then, yeah, you pair it up with some polenta or, you know, whatever, and then, you know, you just got a badass Sunday night dinner.
Hot damn, that sounds good. We are going to take a very quick break, but when we get back, we've got lots more from Ryan Sutton of Bloomberg. You're listening to You Look Hungry. Stay tuned.
This song is called Crying Blues by the California Honey Drops on heritageradionetwork.org. Today's program has been brought to you by TechServe, New York's original and still the best Apple computer, iPod, and iPhone store and repair shop. For more information, visit TechServe.com.
If you're just tuning in, you are listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I am still your host, Helen Holliman, and I'm joined today by Ryan Sutton, the food critic at Bloomberg. Before the break, we were talking about what it means to be a food critic in 2013, the difficulties of it, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I'd love to jump into discussing a recent article that was published in Vanity Fair by Corby Crummer, and it's called Tyranny of Tasting Menus. And Ryan, can you describe what this article is about? And because there's a lot of interesting things going on.
Well, you know, of course, the venerable food writer Corby Crummer could probably explain it best himself, but if you can, you know, briefly paraphrase, is that this food writer is sort of upset with the trend of tasting menus going from shorter to longer. And he basically pins this on two different people, or three different people, Thomas Keller, Charlie Trotter, and Ferran Adrià, late of El Bulli, and now he runs, a restaurant called Tickets in Barcelona, and his brother has a place called 41 Degrees. I apologize if I'm misstating any of that. And he just basically laments how tasting menus have gone from shorter to longer, and he doesn't like some of the food that's being served in some of these restaurants. And yeah, that's the gist of his argument. Of course, I'm oversimplifying it a little bit. And he complains about the new tasting menu at 11 Madison Park. Members of the Culinary Connoisseur, of course, know that 11 Madison Park recently went from a 4-to-6 course menu to an only tasting menu, both lunch and dinner. And by doing so, they kind of, you know, fired their business lunch clientele, because you used to be able to get like a nice short, you know, business lunch there, or shorter business lunch than you would dinner. And now you have the same 3-hour lunch as you do 3-hour dinner. And, you know, in their defense, you know, they had so many people probably on the wait list for dinner, they wanted to be able to serve not these necessarily these business clients, but these destination diners who were flying in from all four corners of the world, you know, to have this full experience. And it's And that experience you get at 11 Madison Park is indicative of what's happening at other fine dining restaurants. You know, you have, you know, Fat Duck in Bray in the United Kingdom. You have the same experience at lunch as you do at dinner, same thing at Per Se. And Corby Crummer is, you know, again, lamenting, you know, the length of tasting menus, which I think is, you know, there's a lot of different ways of looking at it. And he's also lamenting the lack of choice, you know, the fact that diners, you know, few choices on a Thomas Keller tasting menu, almost no choices on an 11 Madison Park tasting menu. I think you have the choice between duck and beef. There are no choices at a Blanca in Bushwick, and there are certainly also no choices at the chef's table at Brooklyn Fair. And Corby Crummer also laments the fact that, you know, some diners and some restaurants are requiring diners to prepay for their culinary experience, which is the case at Alinea in Chicago, which serves about a 20-course menu, and Next Restaurant, which is their slightly off lower-cost offshoot brand of it. So now that I've eloquently described it, I don't necessarily... It sparked this whole debate about all these things, about, you know, the role of choice in eating out. You know, how much choice should a diner have? How much control should a restaurant have? You know, listen, I remember when I was working at Zola one time, and this table from Queens comes up to me, or, you know, I come up to them, I take their order, and this lady's like, and I describe the special to her, and the special is salmon over mashed potatoes, salmon over rice with red peppers on top. Not a great special by any order of magnitude, but this lady from Queens comes up to me, and this is in D.C., and she's like, all right, give me the salmon special, but I want it over mashed potatoes instead, and take off the peppers. And I was beside myself. I didn't want to take it, but, you know, lo and behold, I was the, you know, the lowly waiter, and I put in for the chef. The chef was angry with me, but he did it. And, you know, of course, when you're working in the restaurant, you know, listen, you created this great special. Why would you change it for the diner? But that's just one little anecdote. I think the larger picture is, are diners being mistreated in this new trend towards longer tasting menus, towards less choice, and towards prepayment of dinners? And I say absolutely not. If anything, you know, the diner is the beneficiary. Because this is, if anything else, it's just injecting more choice, you know, into our culinary environment. You know, something I said, you know, when this piece, even before this piece came out, for every tasting menu only restaurant with no choices, there's often a counterpart that gives you choice. So for every Per Se, which is 9 courses for $295, for every Per Se, there's a salon in front of Per Se, which there is, where you can order the foie gras just for $40. You know, for every, I don't know, Alinea in Chicago, which is 200, it's actually dynamic pricing, anywhere from $180 to $265 per person, depending on the day of the week. So for every Alinea, there's a Next, which is their slightly cheaper tasting menu restaurant. For Bennu in San Francisco, which serves only tasting menus on Fridays and Saturdays, and I believe Sundays, the rest of the week, they allow a la carte. So almost every single one of these restaurants gives you another opportunity to try their platform, to try their ambitious food at a lower cost. And of course, even the best example is where we are, Roberta's, which is, we have Blanca, which is $180 per person, tasting menu only, no choices. Then you go to Roberta's next door, and the food is, in some case, equally ambitious, and you can go in, sit at the bar, and have a few plates. So this whole tasting menu controversy, the tyranny of the tasting menu, it's just, in my opinion, a little bit ridiculous. And as I joked on Twitter a few times, you know, tasting menus aren't tyrannical. Belarus is tyrannical. So...
Well, I mean, don't you feel like having a tasting menu is sort of like listening to the whole album versus a mixtape where you can order off the menu? And I guess my question to you would be, these chefs in particular that are mentioned in the article, you know, Thomas Keller and Fran Adria, et cetera, you know, they are a style of chef now where chefs are sort of revered in this artistic sense. Do you think that that is going to remain forever? Do you think that we'll continue as diners to sort of expect, you know, dining to have a whole experience? Or do you think eventually we'll sort of get back to simpler times? What do you think?
I don't know. I certainly hope so. You know, one of the things that, you know, people were worried that, you know, when iTunes came out, that it was the death of the album, that people would, you know, buy singles and only singles. For me, iTunes was a way to listen to albums, because all of a sudden albums, most of them became $10 each, so I could afford them as a young food writer and as a young human rights worker, and so iTunes was my savior. By the same token, I think this new, you know, budget gourmet movement, where some tasting menus are even cheaper than they should be, which I think is the case at Blanca, where there's only $180 per person, I think it's It's exposing young diners to the culinary equivalent of long-form journalism. And I think it's just especially endearing that in a world of ADD everything, Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, three social media platforms that I'm absolutely in love with, that in this era of ADD, we can have a resurgence in this long-form culinary exposition in an era when people want movies to be shorter, no one's going to opera anymore, not as many people are going to the symphony orchestra, but yet young kids, I mean, listen, for me, the biggest defenders of these restaurants like Blanca and Brooklyn Fare have been people, I'm 33 years old, have been people my age, and they're excited about this. And, I mean, who would have vunk it that, a couple of years ago, that, the biggest defenders of long-form culinary tasting menus would be, bloggers like me and journalists like me and people my age, and, and the some of the older types would be complaining about it. I'm not trying to get ad hominem or anything, but I like to think that it's heartwarming that we're trying to take a more serious view of this culinary art instead of just going in and having our 24-ounce steak.
So are you saying that, food is the new art house or opera house, perhaps?
Perhaps. I mean, listen, it's obviously a very different form of cultural imbibement in that, you don't eat Anna Netrebko when you go to see, the opera. It's definitely a different form of indulgence because you're actually putting the thing in your mouth. And so it's a, I've always thought of food and eating at restaurants is a very beautiful form of theater that takes place, and it's something that different that happens at every single different table. And the great job of not just the food critic, but of the Yelper and the blogger and the individual diner is not just to enjoy this, but to recount this beautiful form of theater that happens individually at every single table to their friends. Which is, and I don't mean to get a tangent, which is why I'm such a huge fan of food photography in restaurants. It makes my job easier, and it's part about telling the not the oral history, but the visual history of what's going on in restaurants.
When I was a kid, I remember watching my best friend's wedding, and it was the first time where I saw a celebrity chef, Charlie Trotter, and back then I was like, oh, a food critic, that's interesting. It wasn't something as a kid I was like, oh, that's a job that I could do, until that movie. Anyway, what I'm saying is that nowadays food is the most popular part of pop culture in a lot of ways. We've got Top Chef, we've got rap songs about food, all different medias. Why do you think we're so obsessed with food now?
It's a good question. It's one I've struggled with, and sometimes I've been dismissive of the question, but let me subvert your question slightly. Rather than saying why are we so obsessed with it, I say all the more power to the food movement, because it's such a vital part not just of our culture, but just of the circle of life here on Earth, and the fact that so many people are paying attention to where our food comes from. You ask a guy in the street right now, and he can tell you about the Texas droughts and how that's affecting cattle and how it's affecting cattle prices and how it's affecting food prices. And I think most people right now could give you a good reason of why their steak is more expensive on their plate. A lot of people 10 years ago who could now tell you the difference between a grass-fed steak and a corn-fed steak, and how they taste differently. Why is it a bigger part of our popular culture now? I don't know. Maybe it is just because of Top Chef. Tom Colicchio is now a celebrity. Not just celebrity chef, he's a celebrity. And my parents can speak with intricate detail about all the various characters in Top Chef, a show which I do not watch, but that I have all the respect for. I'm a big fan of the winner of the first season of Top Chef. So the fact that this is, people complain about how these articles about how, complaining about how kids are spending XX percent of their disposable income on food. I know a lot of these people. Sometimes that they're wealthy people, like hedge funds analysts, and sometimes they're not wealthy people. But almost all of them can speak with great eloquence about the food that they're eating. And I think it's just a different manifestation of being a good citizen in the world, knowing about the food, knowing where it comes from, knowing about the people who made the food and how much they're paid and what type of conditions they're working under and what countries they come from, and that's just part of being a global citizen. It's not just environment and narcotics and politics and crime. Food is now a popular topic of discussion, and that's just great for people in the restaurant industry who want to tell this story in so many different and beautiful ways.
Where should I be eating in 2013?
You should be eating. I'm really excited about the Southern Hemisphere in 2013. I just got back from a trip to South America. We'll talk more about that later. But I think there's a really exciting movement, and not just in the Southern Hemisphere. We should be eating food. We should be eating, let me make a somewhat, how shall I say it, in favor of fine dining. We should be eating fine dining and high-end food from cuisines we don't expect. You know, not from France or Spain or America or Italy or Japan. We should be eating, I'm looking forward to high-end Mexican restaurants, high-end Peruvian restaurants, high-end, maybe Indian restaurants. I would love to see a 30-course tasting menu from an Indian restaurant or from a Peruvian restaurant. And you can if you go to Lima and Estrella Gaston and places like that. You know, I have a lot of friends who make this kind of ethnocentric argument that certain cuisines aren't meant to be haute cuisine. They're not meant to be high-end cuisine. They're meant to be communal, and they're meant to be shared around the table. And you know what? Perhaps, I mean, listen, if your whole culinary standard is that, let me rephrase that. I don't think any cuisine in the world was meant to be served in white tablecloths, served by men in tuxedos, you know, using Christofle silverware. No cuisine in the world was meant to be that type of cuisine. But to say that, say, Indian cuisine or Peruvian cuisine or Bolivian cuisine can't be elevated to the same level that, say, French or American cuisine, that's just, it's almost racist to say that. And I'm excited about how these cuisines are moving past the point of, I apologize for this term, ethnic, and internationalizing themselves. And, or if not internationalizing themselves, just refining themselves and finding their own path to development without, you know, resorting to just putting Kobe beef and truffles and foie gras and everything. If you put earrings on an elephant, doesn't make that land animal fancy. And just by the same token, if you put, you know, black truffles on Indian food, it doesn't make Indian food fancy. It's, you know, I think all these countries would be lovely if they have their own, you know, culinary path to development. So I'm excited about this type of ethnic food, again, pardon for the expression, you know, finding its own path towards becoming fancy. Every single cuisine has a right to charge every single chef and every single ethnic cuisine has a right to be expensive and slightly unaffordable. It's one of the lovely things about our culinary world.
Last question is, how is Long Beach since Hurricane Sandy?
Long Beach is a lot better than it was, but still not quite there. You know, I remember taking photos of Long Beach shortly after Sandy and seeing cars buried in sand, seeing the majority of the insides of houses outside of those houses. I wasn't, of course, there. I was evacuated, and, you know, there were 4 feet of water on our block. The boardwalk is now demolished, as it should be, but it's just sad to see the heart of our community in ruins. And will it be back by the summer? We all hope. I don't think anyone actually thinks it will happen. And again, for me, the boardwalk is the lifeblood of our community. I've probably spent more time on the Long Beach boardwalk than I have anywhere else in the past 10 years outside of my own home and restaurants. And so the fact that's no longer is terribly sad, but, you know, it's a process of rebuilding. You know, we all hope that Swing Belly's, one of the best restaurants in Long Beach, will recover. It will soon reopen. Unemployment right now is 10% in Long Beach, which is higher than the national average. National average right now is 7.8%. So Long Beach is in some dire straits, but FEMA has helped us out, helped out my family. My cousin just moved, who's a chef, just moved back to Long Beach. And, you know, we'll recover like any strong community. It won't be the same, but, you know, we'll get back on our feet because we have such a lovely beach and a lovely ocean. And I think we have a lot of spirit in us. And I can't wait to get back home to Long Beach this weekend. That's how much I love that city. And it's such a lovely place to live.
Well, Ryan, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
And for more about Ryan and his reviews, you can check him out at Bloomberg, as well as on Twitter. And you've got two amazing blogs as well. And as always, thanks so much to Jack Inslee, the rest of the crew at Heritage Radio and Roberta's. I'll see y'all next week.
Let's go out to eat and get some meat.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Protein, sodium, different foods. You know you wanna get a hold of them. Different foods.